Thank you. Well, let's begin. You're looking at an icon there. It's actually an icon. It's a painting by Van Gogh. And you can tell what it is. There are two people. It's a bit shadowy, of course, with all the, but there are two people there gazing up at the stars and watching them reflected in the water. As far as I'm able to ascertain, the word contemplation, I'm sure you can see in the middle of the word temple, can't you? Contemplation. So it's about temple, and the ancient peoples, and I think as it first came into our language, they saw the stars as revealing God and God's will. You know, the story of the Magi is about that. Watching for the directions of the stars. So the word contemplation comes from that image of the star-spangled sky as a temple where God dwells, of course, in the heavens. And we gaze into the heavens, searching for meaning and searching for God's direction and the movements of the stars, etc. As I'm talking to this morning, and as you know already, yes, the stars, heavens, is a temple. So, as Michelle was telling us last evening, so are the beautiful forest that we've got out here, the bush, is a temple. And eventually we're going to come, which you know already, that you're a temple too, and I'm a temple. So we're gazing into where God is to discover our communion with God. Another word, and don't let me distract you with too many, but you all use the word consider, to consider something. It may not have occurred to you that the S-I-D-E-R comes straight from the Latin. Sidus, sideris, is a star. So in the origins of our language, to consider was precisely what I've been talking about. Another way of saying looking at the stars, to wonder at the incredible, with awe at the divine, and to search for communion and direction in our life. But we need to look, our topic is contemplating the mystery. So I do need to define a few words. And as I said, this is all available for you later. When we use the word mystery in English, we sometimes, this is my best shot at it anyhow, we talk about experience that's puzzling. We can't fully understand it. Midsummer murders. Who committed the murder? It's all very tricky and we're looking for the evidence. The last one was last Sunday, so I have to go into hibernation now till another good program comes on. But anyhow, you may not all watch that, but you might. So that's a mystery, to be solved by getting the data and inquiry and careful planning. We're not using mystery in that sense. Another sense of the word mystery is not that something's dark and obscure and we have to solve it. Rather, there's too much light for us to take in. It's the sense of attraction that we have. We all have it. You wouldn't be here if you didn't. A sense of presence. We can't fully understand it, yes, but we experience insight and enlightenment. Our heart is engaged as we're drawn into communion, whether you're looking at the stars or wherever, looking at the scriptures or just looking into your own heart. We don't seek to solve anything, but we are drawn to yield to the attraction that is drawing us. And we have a word God for that attraction. When we come to the word contemplation, the scholars speak about four kinds. And this might help us introduce the topic. One is aesthetic contemplation. And I've defined it there for you as the delight we have when we're experiencing beauty and are drawn into communion with what is beautiful. You might have just had a grandchild recently. And we're all drawn to babies because they're so beautiful. Actually, we're quite beautiful too, just a bit older. So this this attraction can lead, as you know, to a deeper contemplation when we yield to the one that we sense is mysteriously present in the beauty that we're experiencing, of another person, of the sky, sunset, leaf, whatever. You have plenty of that around you here, and I'm sure at home. That's aesthetic contemplation, but it can draw us into the contemplation that I want to share with you this morning. Here's a beautiful statement from St. Paul on that. Since the creation of the world, invisible realities, God's eternal power and divinity, has become visible, recognized through the things that God has made. None of that is new to you. A second form of contemplation that the people, scholars, talk about is intellectual contemplation. I'm sure you've all had this. It's the delight we experience when we get insight into something. A famous one of, was it Archimedes who got in the bath and worked out how to, he didn't know whether the crown of the king was pure gold or had stuff in it that was making it look like gold, but it really wasn't, and he was wondering how to test it. If you don't know the story, I'm sorry if you do, but anyhow. And he got into the bath, and he noticed, when he got in, of course, that it displaced a certain amount of water. And he realised, if it was pure gold, it was going to displace more water than it was gold with other junk in it. So he raced through Syracuse saying, "Eureka, I've got it. I understand. I found it." Well, you've all had that experience in many ways. That's an insight that you get into reality, your own and other people's, that gives delight to you, to me. This too, this intellectual contemplation, can yield to deeper contemplation as we come to appreciate the truth we have discovered is a partial revelation of a more mysterious truth in which it participates. Everything belongs to everything else, and if we follow any truth, if we get any insight into anything and we're committed to the truth, it will take us to the truth. Here again, we're being drawn into communion with the mysterious one in whom everything participates. They talk about theological contemplation. That's a picture there of in St. Peter's at the back, you know, that's St. Peter's chair there. So-called, it's a very ancient chair anyhow, and it's now been surrounded with gold and various things. And there's the Holy Spirit there. And down here you've got the four first doctors of the church. The ones with the mitres are from the west, Ambrose and Augustine. And the two here that are a bit hard to pick out, but don't have a mitre, are two from the Eastern Church, Athanasius and John Chrysostom. But there they are, the East and the West Church. These incredibly intelligent but also saintly people who their contemplation was the wonders of theology. I'll read what I've written there. The delight that we experience in accepting in trust the truths of faith and enjoying what they reveal to us of the God whom we're seeking and whom we sense is drawing us into communion. We could never work out the incarnation on our own. That's not a matter for science or logic. It's just an incredibly wonderful thing that's beyond our comprehension, but there's so much light in it. And to be taught that and to believe it, which is a choice, of course, we make the choice to believe that, opens up a whole lot of things for us. The doctrine of the Trinity. Many saints have been taken into extreme contemplation through the wonder of what they were taught and welcomed, and it made sense to them the more they lived. Now, they never could comprehend it or work it out for ourselves, but as they progressed into the mischief, they were taken into the contemplation I'm going to move to in a moment. And here it is. It's called by the scholars again supernatural or infused contemplation. So that's you there sitting quietly somewhere here. And this is the special graced delight, and delight seems to be the word that always occurs, that we experience in God Himself. Beyond whatever reflections of God we may find in creation and beyond the categories of theology. It's a communion that we're drawn into as a gift. God is experienced, and this is terribly important, but I don't know that I'm not wise enough to do it well, but anyhow, I'll come give him my best shot. But what attracts me is when people say we don't experience God as an object. That's kind of so important. I experience each of you as an object. I mean that in the best sense. You're someone who's come into my consciousness, an object of insight and love and whatever. But God's not like that. God isn't another object among all the objects of the world, another thing. Some cultures speak beautifully about God, and they say God is nothing, no thing. God is beyond things. Doesn't mean God doesn't exist. So God is experienced, but not as an object. It's a faith experience. And we all know they're so important. It's a choice we make to believe. And if we make a choice to believe, and it makes no sense, and it makes us more miserable, more petty, more out of touch, well, then it's junk. We're believing something wrong, and someone has to shake us up and say, look, you're looking in the wrong place. But if you make a choice to believe something based on beautiful people that you've met, parents perhaps, teachers, and reading of the saints, if you make this choice to believe, and it is a choice, and it makes more and more sense, and you become more and more gentle and humble and prayerful and loving, and well, for God's sake, let's keep, it's a good choice, so let's hold to it and keep letting it grow in us. By their fruits you'll know, Jesus said. This is a faith experience in which we experience God as a subject. Not quite sure what I mean by that or what others mean by it, but I've got a bit of a feel for it, and maybe you'll have a better one. Because I experience myself as a subject. I can also be an object of my reflections. But basically, I'm the subject of the verb, and I experience myself as the one knowing and seeing, and so do you. Well, if you reflect on that experience you have as yourself as a subject, that's how we experience God. We experience ourselves as being one in a communion of love with the source of our being. When I say experience, I mean a faith experience, a chosen experience, a commitment experience. The Carmelite, Marie Eugène, a French Carmelite whose beatification is in process, a very saintly man, says it like this. You see how it might appeal to you or not. Out of the darkness of the mystery, and we've touched that, there arises, through the gifts of the Holy Spirit, a confused light, and I know not what, that makes a person find peace and sweetness in the mystery that holds faith there or brings it back. Freeing it from the discursive operations of the intellect, which are important but of course limited, and causing it to find rest and support in this light that is beyond all distinct lights. one of the loveliest stanzas in John of the Cross's spiritual canticle is the one I'm about to share with you. O spring like crystal, he says, if only on your silvered over face. So imagine a spring, imagine the water and it's silvered over. If only you would suddenly form the eyes that I have desired, which I bear sketched deep within my heart. He's actually talking about theological insight, theological contemplation. He's talking about the truths of our faith, the ascension of Jesus, the resurrection, the incarnation, etc. And they're like, the theological statement is like a silvered over surface, a still, may I say, pond or lake. But he knows that through those statements of faith that we have in the catechism and that we've learned since we were children probably, he's longing for something to happen at depth as he chooses to believe these truths. And what he's looking for, it's there. If only you would suddenly form the eyes that I have desired, which I bear sketched deep within my heart. We're made for something bigger than theology, and we're looking for communion, and we're looking for his eyes, the Gospels are full of it, to gaze from the depths of this spring-like crystal into our eyes and catch that glance. John of the Cross, is aware of the importance of theological contemplation and so of the silver plating of dogma. The formulas which express in words the truths revealed by God are not empty. They clothe the substance of divine truth itself, which is revealed in them. And it's only revealed, finally, deeply in contemplation, which is our topic. If we welcome the wisdom of the Christian community, and it's 2,000 years of it there for us, if we submit humbly to dogma, to the truths of faith that have come down through, grace can lead us to penetrate the mystery that the dogma expresses. However, it's one thing to delight in the truth of faith. It's another to experience the gaze of the one for whom our hearts long. That's why you've come here on retreat. That's why I'm here. That's why we're all here. We're wanting to experience, it's an image, but it's a pretty vital, the eyes that draw us. Contemplate, we're not contemplating the stars particularly, we're contemplating, well I'll come to a bit later, Jesus. In contemplation, our attention is not on any insights that we may receive. I should be blushing here because when I go to prayer and I get a thought, I'm always tempted, oh dear, this sounds like a general confession, and I often give in to the temptation to rush to my room to write it down so I can write an article on it. Don't laugh at me. But you know what I mean? Maybe you've got a bit of that in you. But the insights are not what it's... They're good. Good to get them, but that's not what it's about. These insights are important. And if they've got value, they'll stay. Don't stop praying to write them down. God, who is uniting himself to us in love, wants our whole attention. Wants your whole attention. In contemplation, we're being transformed into love by the all-consuming love which we call God. And we all want that. accompanying this, you've got to check all this for yourself, of course. I'm just giving you my best insights into it. And some of it will go over your head, I hope, and some of it might touch you and inspire you to pick up your own experience. Accompanying this experience of love, there is joy, as well as a sense of belonging, communion, and peace. This is the love for which we are made and for which we long. The communion in love which we experience is experienced as a gift. We're not doing it. We can't do it. It comes as gift. We're quite aware of the fact that the silence, the stillness, the welling up of joy or gratitude or sorrow or pleading is not something we're organizing. It wells up unexpectedly. And our hearts know it's from God. It's a faith knowledge, but the faith knowledge is the deepest form of knowledge. It's a love knowledge. It's not simply an intellectual conviction. It's knowing. And we know it's a gift from God. Contemplation can come to any person at any time. For God invites everyone to the intimate communion for which we're created. It would be such a tragedy if I or you were to think of this as an esoteric thing for people like Teresa of Avila or whatever. No, this is a gift. It is a gift, but it's given everyone. God doesn't hold back gifts. God is God. So everyone is given the gift differently, but it's given, so believe it's given and you'll receive it. In these graced moments, everything is experienced as a sacrament of the divine. Everything, to use Gerard Manley Hopkins' beautiful phrase, everything is charged with the grandeur of God. In these graced moments, and I think moments is the right word, we experience a new kind of presence in which we're not alone. We're embraced by the one who gives harmony to the music of creation, or to use Paul's words, in whom all things hold together. Our mind rests in the true that is given, the true that is beyond the truths which we discover through the efforts of reason and logic to which we're committed. Our mind, in contemplation, rests in the true God who is given. Our will rests in the good that is given, the good which is beyond any efforts we're making to live a consistently moral life. And we are making those efforts. But this is something beyond all that. And our feelings rest in the beautiful. The beautiful that is given beyond anything that we might appreciate by our own efforts. We can receive these graced moments in the measure that we're willing to let go control and entrust ourselves wholly to God. Whereas before we experienced ourselves seeking and striving, and they're all good things, now we experience ourselves welcoming. We're in a different place. Think of Mary, one of the loveliest stanzas in John of the Cross's spiritual canticle is the one I'm about to share with you. O spring, like crystal, it says, if only on your silvered over face. So imagine spring, imagine the water, and it's silvered over. If only you would suddenly form the eyes that I have desired, which I bear sketched deep within my heart. He's actually talking about theological insight, theological contemplation. He's talking about the truths of our faith, the ascension of Jesus, the resurrection, the incarnation, etc. And they're like, the theological statement is like a silvered over surface of a still, may I say, pond or lake. But he knows that through those statements of faith that we have in the catechism and that we've learned since we were children probably, he's longing for something to happen at depth as he chooses to believe these truths. And what he's looking for, it's there. If only you would suddenly form the eyes that I have desired, which I bear sketched deep within my heart. We're made for something bigger than theology, and we're looking for communion, and we're looking for his eyes, the Gospels are full of it, to gaze from the depths of this spring-like crystal into our eyes and catch that glance. John of the Cross, is aware of the importance of theological contemplation and so of the silver plating of dogma. The formulas which express in words the truths revealed by God are not empty. They clothe the substance of divine truth itself, which is revealed in them. And it's only revealed, finally, deeply in contemplation, which is our topic. If we welcome the wisdom of the Christian community, and it's 2,000 years of it there for us, if we submit humbly to dogma, to the truths of faith that have come down through, grace can lead us to penetrate the mystery that the dogma expresses. However, it's one thing to delight in the truth of faith. It's another to experience the gaze of the one for whom our hearts long. That's why you've come here on retreat. That's why I'm here. That's why we're all here. We're wanting to experience, it's an image, but it's a pretty vital, the eyes that draw us. Contemplate, we're not contemplating the stars particularly, we're contemplating, well I'll come to a bit later, Jesus. In contemplation, our attention is not on any insights that we may receive. I should be blushing here because when I go to prayer and I get a thought, I'm always tempted, oh dear, this is sounding like a general confession, that I often give in to the temptation to rush to my room to write it down so I can write an article on it. Don't laugh at me. But you know what I mean? Maybe you've got a bit of that in you. But the insights are not what it's... They're good. Good to get them, but that's not what it's about. These insights are important. And if they've got value, they'll stay. Don't stop praying to write them down. God, who is uniting himself to us in love, wants our whole attention. Wants your whole attention. In contemplation, we're being transformed into love by the all-consuming love which we call God. And we all want that. Accompanying this, you've got to check all this for yourself, of course. I'm just giving you my best insights into it. And some of it will go over your head, I hope, and some of it might touch you and inspire you to pick up your own experience. Accompanying this experience of love, there is joy, as well as a sense of belonging, communion, and peace. This is the love for which we are made and for which we long. The communion in love which we experience is experienced as a gift. We're not doing it. We can't do it. It comes as gift. We're quite aware of the fact that the silence, the stillness, the welling up of joy or gratitude or sorrow or pleading is not something we're organizing. It wells up unexpectedly. And our hearts know it's from God. It's a faith knowledge, but the faith knowledge is the deepest form of knowledge. It's a love knowledge. It's not simply an intellectual conviction. It's knowing. And we know it's a gift from God. Contemplation can come to any person at any time. For God invites everyone to the intimate communion for which we're created. It would be such a tragedy if I or you were to think of this as an esoteric thing for people like Teresa of Avila or whatever. No, this is a gift. It is a gift, but it's given everyone. God doesn't hold back gifts. God is God. So everyone is given the gift differently, but it's given, so believe it's given and you'll receive it. In these graced moments, everything is experienced as a sacrament of the divine. Everything, to use Jared Manley Hopkins' beautiful phrase, everything is charged with the grandeur of God. In these graced moments, and I think moments is the right word, we experience a new kind of presence in which we're not alone. We're embraced by the one who gives harmony to the music of creation, or to use Paul's words, in whom all things hold together. Our mind rests in the true that is given, the true that is beyond the truths which we discover through the efforts of reason and logic to which we're committed. Our mind, in contemplation, rests in the true God who is given. Our will rests in the good that is given. The good, which is beyond any efforts we're making to live a consistently moral life. And we are making those efforts. But this is something beyond all that. And our feelings rest in the beautiful. The beautiful that is given beyond anything that we might appreciate by our own efforts. We can receive these graced moments in the measure that we're willing to let go control and entrust ourselves wholly to God. Whereas before we experienced ourselves seeking and striving, and they're all good things, now we experience ourselves welcoming. We're in a different place. Think of Mary of Place. Think of Mary of Magdala, the tomb in the Gospel stories. She was seeking and searching. And then Jesus said to her, Mary, and she welcomed. She moved to a embrace, a welcome. This communion is offered to everyone who's willing to make space for love and surrender to it. Are you, am I really wanting to make space for love? And are we willing to give in, to surrender to it? Please God, we are. It's important, a final point of this introductory section, it's important to remember that we can experience contemplation in the midst of activity. Jesus did. As well as in the stillness of prayer. For whenever we're doing God's will, we're open to his gift of himself in this way. Our focus, however, in this retreat is on contemplative prayer. And we've got a whole week to go into it. I'm just starting it off, jumping into quite deep water, I suppose, but it'll be taken further in the rest of the week. So we're focusing on contemplative prayer here rather than contemplative action, but one isn't better than the other. It's communion with God that matters, whatever, active, silent. So if we're willing to remain open to these graced moments when God draws us to himself beyond all our thoughts and feelings, and if we resist the temptation to take control of them or possess them or attempt to reproduce them, that beautiful prayer you had 10 years ago on retreat, you'd like to have it again. It's got nothing to do with you, so please don't go on that track. This is God gifting something well beyond what happened 10 years ago. If we keep trying to reproduce it, we're controlling it. We're not letting God, we're not welcoming. God's longing to be in communion with us is such that transcendent, transient experiences of recollection tend to deepen so that the soul finds itself wrapped in quiet prayer. That's the tendency to deepen. There is, I'm sure you know this, but there is a simple form of, I'll call it pre-contemplative prayer, that is within our power to practice. There are a lot of things we can do in prayer. A lot of techniques, a lot of methods that are good, some, most are good. So there's a lot within our power to do, as long as we remember it's pre-contemplative, it's not contemplation. Anything we can do is not contemplation. In this prayer, we hold ourselves quietly in the presence of God. We can all do that. A prayer of simple regard. Teresa of Avila talks about it, John of the Cross talks about it, everyone talks about it. In some ways, contemplative prayer is similar to this pre-contemplative prayer of quiet, we might call it. Stillness, silence, that we can actually organise by breathing and then the rest of the techniques you know. The essential difference is that in contemplative prayer, we can only receive as a gift and welcome the communion with God that God offers us. We can't do contemplative prayer, but we can welcome it and let God take us where God wants to take us. We can desire contemplative prayer, of course we can. We can prepare for it, of course we can, but we can't bring it about. So we mustn't try, because we're missing the whole point of it. We're receivers of God's love, not organisers of it. Here's Gerald May in his wonderful book, The Awakened Heart, and he writes, it's pretty strong, but I think it's right, he says, any attempt to create a contemplative attitude will lead to frustration or worse, to self-delusion. Have all the techniques we know, do them. They can all be good, but don't think that's contemplation. Or you've blocked off the gift When we were in control of our prayer, we worked for such quiet. Now, the quiet wells up from the mysterious depths of our soul. We're drawn into an experience of prayer from within. In pre-contemplative prayer, we found ways of quietening down our imagination, good, our memory, good, our mind, good. But now, surprised by grace, these same faculties, to quote St. Teresa, are absorbed and looking as though in wonder at what they see. We're contemplating because we're wondering at the gift. Therese in Interior Castle has two images. They're quite helpful, I think. One is you've got a trough or a hole, call it what you like, and you want to get water into it. But there's water a long way away. So to get the water from there into this trough, you have a whole series of goats going round in a circle, dragging the thing in water paddles and canals, and you finally, with a lot of effort, you get the water into the trough. You understand that? And that's what we do with all our initial prayer, trying to do all this, because we want the water. Contemplation, she says here, the water that is refreshing the garden of the soul just comes up from its source. So the water container is right, and the source just bubbles up into it. It's not doing anything to get it, we're just receiving it. And that's what we all want. Teresa again, thinking of God as being in the centre of the soul, radiating out the fire of his love, is a different image but equally beautiful. Teresa states, the warmth and the fragrant perfumes spread through the entire soul. We've made space for it. We've committed ourselves to the time for God, and we don't go away from it. We stay with it without expectation but with longing. And God, when we're ready, will allow this grace. Now the touch of God leaves us dissatisfied with any other pleasure. Our souls long for the communion experienced in the silence and stillness granted us by God. Now our prayer is no longer guided by our previous experiences or any efforts of our mind or will. We're conscious of ourselves being moved and being inspired. We're conscious of surrendering ourselves in love. God is leading you and me on the way of love. If only over your silvered over face I could behold the eyes that I have sketched deep within my heart. Contemplative prayer, says Gerald May, is allowing the source of love to bring us toward the place which is our home. It's your heart, your centre, you. I'd be quite foolish if I tried to give the impression that when we have a gift of contemplation, that everything's light and love. Jesus was contemplating his Father on the cross in Calvary, and I don't think it was that easy. It wasn't kind of... We're the recipients of a wonderful grace of communion, but we're not yet in heaven. In contemplative prayer, we're in the presence of the sacred mystery that we call God. We're therefore in touch with the one who's at the heart of, but always beyond, everything. And being transcendent God cannot be contained or controlled. Being immanent, God opens us up to the real world, your real world and my real world, where there's pain and suffering and people who we depend on, who depend on us, on things that are not working, on, you, well, just for your life, you know what's happening in your life, and a lot of it is quite painful, as it was for Jesus. But what God opens us to in our contemplative prayer is the real world, our own real world in all its grace and disgrace. Contemplative prayer therefore opens us, to quote the Vatican Council, to the joys and hopes, but also to the griefs and anxieties of the men and women of our time, especially those who are poor or afflicted in any way. Those beautiful people in Nepal, many of whom would have obviously been terribly prayerful people, didn't stop the earthquake and didn't stop death, because that's our world we're in. But you'd be confident that it would enable them to love through it. It opens us to the suffering and brokenness of the world as much as to its joys and beauty. We shouldn't expect it to be otherwise, for prayer engages us with what is ultimately real. A prayer that's an escape is simply that, it's not prayer. It's in contemplative prayer that God is transforming our souls so that, like St. Paul, one day you may be already able to say this. I'm looking forward to it. Don't know how long I've got to look forward, but anyhow, I'm looking forward to it. Wouldn't it be wonderful to be able to say, I live, no longer I, but Christ lives in me. I mean, that's dear St. Paul. Our mind is being transformed into the mind of Christ. Our heart is becoming his heart. It is his communion of love which we're being invited to experience. That's very consoling and profound. We're being invited into Jesus' prayer, into his communion with the Father. I'll come to that pretty well immediately. It's watching him that we learn how to be contemplative. Like a log in a fire, one of John of the Cross's favourite images. This will require a profound purification of your mind and will and mine. When the log's in the fire, it sputters and all the liquid that's in it has to come out of it, and it blackens and it's burning away whatever is not pure, until all that's there are beautiful coals. The wood has been transformed into the fire. There's only fire there. And letting go our ego, as you know, can be quite painful. When you search for me, says Jeremiah, you will find me. That's beautiful, encouraging. So you've got all this retreat time. You're searching. It wouldn't be if you weren't. Well, you will find, he says, if you seek me with all your heart, I'll let you find me, says Yahweh. Psalm 38, O Lord, all my longing is known to you. My sighing is not hidden from you. Psalm 38. My soul, Psalm 42, my soul thirsts for God, for the living God. When shall I come and behold the face of God? Nothing can prepare our soul for the gift of contemplative prayer. Nothing can lead us to behold the face of God better than contemplation of Jesus. So let me now spend some time with him as we come to conclude this. So if I want to know what contemplative prayer is and experience it, faith experience of course, believe it, then he's the one to watch. So there's an icon, there's Jesus open to communion with God. There's John saying in his first letter, we declare to you what we've heard, what we've seen with our eyes, what we've looked at and touched. Touched with our hands concerning the word of life. This life was revealed and we've seen it. And we testify to it and we declare to you the eternal life that was with the Father and was revealed to us. We saw him praying, in other words. We declare to you what we've seen and heard so that you may have communion with us. And truly our communion is with the Father and with his Son, Jesus, the Messiah. There's John, the beloved disciple, leaning against the breast of Jesus at the Last Supper, learning there how to contemplate, to open to that gift that Jesus had all the time. My Father is always with me. That was what was most impressive about Jesus, and John picked it up. That's where we'll pick it up too. From his fullness, John assures us, we've all received, so it's a gift given to everyone in this room, grace upon grace. Our founder, Jules Chevalier, wrote in a book called The Heart of Jesus, it's quite beautiful really, I hope you like it. He wrote, the heart of God descends in haste to his creation, to you in this retreat, to me. The heart of God descends in haste to his creation with the weight of an infinite love. And the heart of creation rises towards God, including your heart, of course, rises towards God, drawn by an attraction that dominates all others in it. It's in Jesus, says Jules Chevalier. It's in Jesus that the two hearts meet, heart of God and the heart of creation. And they unite so profoundly that the two hearts become one. And that's what we'd love to have. That the longing of creation as you've experienced it in you and God's longing for the whole of creation in your heart, contemplative heart, they meet. So that you've become, you're yourself at your deepest level, you're in communion with God. You trust it, you believe it, and you continue in it, and it bears fruit. There's the beautiful mother and her son, picking up from each other, of course, this contemplation. Mary and John at the foot of the cross. These are the places we have to go to, can go to, want to go to. And if we go open and letting God give us what he wants to give us, he wants to give us contemplative prayer. From the pierced heart of Jesus on the cross, says John, there flowed out blood and water. And the early church has seen that always as the water of baptism, the blood of the Eucharist, the gift, the church, which taught us our theology. If you know me, said Jesus at the Last Supper, you'll know my Father, From now on, you do know him. You've seen him. And Philip said, Lord, show us the Father, and we'll be satisfied. And Jesus said, have I been with you all this time, Philip, and you still don't know me? Whoever sees me sees the Father. They see his prayer, his communion, the spring from which all his activity comes, and that's the divine, that's God. And Jesus is saying, have a look at it. You're seeing God working in me, in Jesus. Nearly concluded. He's a stunning statement from the Last Supper discourse of the beloved disciple. And it's about the Trinity. It's about God coming to you to draw you into contemplative love. If you love me, said Jesus, you'll keep my commandments. You'll do what I've entrusted to you. You'll love one another as I've loved you. And I'll ask the Father, and he'll give you another advocate, another paraclete, who'll be with you forever. That's the Spirit of Jesus. And tomorrow morning, the next talk will be focusing on the Holy Spirit. And Michelle will be offering her meditation to you. This is the Spirit of truth, whom the world cannot receive, because it neither sees nor knows the Spirit of truth. But you know him, because he abides with you, and he'll be in you. And he goes on very beautifully to say, I won't leave you orphaned, I'm coming to you. Yes, I'm sending my Spirit, but I'm coming. That's how Jesus comes to us, through his Spirit. I'm coming to you. And if you love me and keep my word, and my Father will love you, and we'll come to you. The Father, the Son, and the Spirit, the Trinity, dwelling in our hearts, and trusting that, welcoming that gift, is contemplation. We make our home in you. So there's the icon of Jesus on the cross and these last words in John, I thirst. Second last words, I thirst. What's he thirsting for? He's thirsting for eternal communion with his Father, uninterrupted by the dreadful things that have just happened to him. Just he's thirsting for that communion, which of course he has forever. But he's also thirsting for you to enjoy it with him. For me, for the whole world, I'll draw everyone to myself. So he's just thirsting to see. I've come to cast fire on the earth, and I want it to be there, burning, blazing. I'm going to conclude with a piece of music you can just enjoy. It's the Aramaic Lord's Prayer. So I want you to imagine, if you would, Jesus praying this in the agony, praying it on the cross. It's the Our Father, but it's in Jesus' own language. And you can hear the cry coming from the heart of Jesus in the real agony and disappointment and abandonment and all the mess that we know happened in Jesus' life. But none of it ultimately mattered, because he stayed in communion with my Father is always with me. He said, that's what matters for you and me too. So give me a minute and I'll play that for you.
Bye.